or Hillary Clinton. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yes. Well, you know, Fortune magazine does these analyses of who's a good employer. Wegmans Supermarkets, where I am here in Rochester, New York, is often cited as a really good employer and with good reason. So they looked at 496 major companies, and Trump's casino company was at the bottom or almost at the bottom in terms of management competence, how it treated its workers, its return to its investors, every metric they had near the bottom. Donald is not a manager. He is a deal maker. And the principal elements of Trump deals are these. You borrow a lot of money. You then arrange later to pay back less than you owed, whether you do it through private transactions, by threatening to go to bankruptcy court or actual bankruptcy in the case of his casino company. You don't pay people who work for you or vendors what's promised. And what I don't understand, Amy, is not one major news organization has even tried to check these things out. I got one phone call from the Washington Post about this piece, 21 Questions for Donald Trump. Nothing has appeared. And that's because in this country, politics reporters cover the horse race and they do not vet the candidates the way they should. And Trump, if vetted properly, would quickly disappear from the polls.
And does that go to explain why he continues to rise in the polls among Republican voters despite this incredible record of all these years?
Well, I don't think people know about his actual record. He is appealing to the worst instincts in us. He is appealing to racial instincts. And, you know, let's recognize that, well, in polite society, you can't say, I don't want to sit next to a black person or a brown person or an Asian person on the airplane or in a restaurant or at work. You can't say that. And so there's an undercurrent of people who hate that. They want to live in a white society. They want to imagine this is a Christian country, even though the Constitution expressly in Article 6 makes clear it's not a religious country in any way. And Donald has provided a way for those people who harbor these bad thoughts, I would argue they harbor these inhumane thoughts, to channel them through him. And they are so enamored of this, they ignore the fact that he is proposing to create a massive police state to round up people, to have we were required to have adjudicatory hearings, although Donald likes to think he's would be a dictator, and spend enormous amounts of money on removing people from the country, including children born here who are citizens, and erecting a wall which will do absolutely nothing to stop people coming here in an effort to find a better life. So people who harbor these awful feelings and suffer from the social disease of white skin privilege just aren't really thinking through what Donald is proposing, which is a massive new government program that's totally contrary to the Republican promise of less government.
David Kai Johnston, we want to thank you for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, previously with the New York Times, now writing for Al Jazeera America, as well as contributing writer at Newsweek. We'll link to your column on your 21 questions for Donald Trump at democracynow.org. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Caron, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud, Juan Carlos Davila, Pedro Rodriguez, Mike DeFilippo, and Miguel Nogueira are engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Vesta Gadars. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our website, democracynow.org.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland. Up next, the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Red Umbrella film series hosted by the Clinton Street Theater. This month, the film My Own Private Idaho will be shown Sunday, August 30th at 7 p.m. Directed by Gus Van Sant, My Own Private Idaho adapts Shakespeare's Henry IV story to friends and hustlers living on the streets of Portland. Again, that's My Own Private Idaho at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Living in your own private Idaho. Living in your own private Idaho.
Dip, 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 dip. Sha-la-la, sha-la-la. Looking for a career? KBOO is proud to be a co-sponsor of Oregon's 15th Annual Diversity Employment Day Career Fair. The fair will be held Wednesday, August 26th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Ambridge Events Center, located at 1333 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. Participants may interview with over 50 major employers who are recruiting for hundreds of positions. The career fair is sponsored by the DiversityRecruitersNetwork.org. Business attire is required and bring plenty of resumes. More information is available at citycareerfair.com or on the right-hand side of the KBOO homepage at kboo.fm.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a sociologist and expert in immigration policy called Donald Trump's immigration policies moronic.
Protesters against the planned Trans-Pacific Partnership gather in New Zealand.
And the White House hired its first openly transgender staffer this week.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 19th, 2015. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. At least 12 large wildfires are burning through the Oregon countryside, uncontained, according to Northwest Fire officials. Several more currently burn in Washington, putting all of the region's 8,000 firefighters to work as resources stretch thin. Residents have been evacuated from towns in Idaho and eastern Washington in response to two different fires. Perhaps the most serious of the blazes is the Canyon Creek complex, which has destroyed 36 houses near John Day in rural Grant County, Oregon. That fire continues to threaten homes and other structures today, even as Governor Kate Brown tours the area. The desert floor north of Warm Springs is scarred and black in the wake of the County Line 2 fire, which has burned more than 60,000 acres on Oregon's largest Indian reservation. U.S. officials reported last week that July 2015 was the hottest month on Earth since scientists began keeping records more than 140 years ago. Barring drastic change, this year will be the hottest on record overall, edging out last year. The current heat wave, combined with a years-long drought, has helped make this possibly the worst fire season since 1926, according to the Idaho State Land Board. NASA and the Japan Meteorological Agency attribute the scorching heat to El Nino and to global climate change.
We now hear about planned water releases and the fact that the native tribes in the Klamath River Basin are not happy with the planned amounts. From Daniel Menz with FSRN in Eureka, California.
What do we want?
Water!
What do we want?
Now!
What do we want?
Water!
What do we want?
Now!
What do we want?
The U.S. Bureau of Reclamation is expected to incrementally release water into California's Klamath River system this week, and Native American tribes are describing the planned releases as being too minimal to protect the river's salmon population. The month-long period of water releases from Trinity Lake dams will boost Klamath River flows and reduce water temperature, aimed to prevent a fish kill like the one seen in 2002, when 50,000 Chinook salmon died from disease due to low flows. If another fish kill appears imminent, the Bureau plans to double the volume of the releases for 1 week to flush out the parasites that cause disease. But the plan is controversial. Tribal biologists say higher volume releases should be done before emergency conditions develop. Earlier this month, the Bureau held an open house event at a hotel in Arcata, California, to present its long-term water management plan. Members of the Hoopa Valley and Yurok tribes held a demonstration on the street and moved inside when the event began. Many of those in attendance were disappointed that there was no public comment period on the event's agenda. but there was public comment nonetheless.
We exist still, and we want to continue existing, and we need our water.
Surrounded by tribal youth and adults holding signs, Yurok tribal member Analia Hillman spoke into a microphone that had been left on a podium following a presentation from the Bureau.
Your practices and your irresponsibility is outright environmental racism. Your practices and your policies show bias towards agribusiness and corporations.
Other tribal members who spoke also demanded that fisheries be a priority. California is in the fourth year of a drought cycle, and the need for water is acute statewide. Asked about the demands that more water be diverted into the river system than under the current plan, Bureau of Reclamation Deputy Public Affairs Officer Lewis Moore said managing water during a drought is a balancing act.
We're beginning this entire year with a limited water supply. No snowmelt to supplement what waters we had in the system. So we have to become creative in meeting the demand that's on the table. So we talk to the various interests and we try to find out what's the minimum we can do to support the system. And what's important about that is if we release the volume of waters that are being asked for, we're depleting the system that much quicker and we don't have a replenishing resource.
Tribal biologists disagree with the Bureau's criteria for triggering emergency releases and are also asking for more water during the one-month flow augmentation. Mike Belchick, the Yurok tribe's senior fisheries biologist, said, quote, "The risk factors are simply too high this year to give the bare minimum necessary to prevent a fish kill." Despite the public outcry and contradictory evidence, the Bureau is moving forward with its original release amounts. A final version of the long-term Klamath Management Plan will be released in the summer of 2016. Daniel Mintz, FSRN, Eureka, California.
Could summer pains lead to winter rains? If El Nino follows its usual pattern, the record-setting heat could be followed by a sudden and massive end to the drought that has plagued California and other western states for years. El Nino is a warm current that occurs sometimes in the Pacific Ocean near the equator. When the surface temperature of the Pacific goes up, weather gets extreme all over North America. North America sees record highs, Peru sees torrential rains, Australia suffers terrible droughts, and most of the time, California gets drenched in the wintertime. Though the rains may be a boon to a state desperate for water, they can be dangerous. California has a long history of floods and landslides, and most cities are unprepared for large amounts of rain. Though the cities remain unprepared, farmers have been hit hard by drought and climate change, and many are ready for the coming floods. The most important weapon in their arsenal is flood capturing, a process by which farmers use flood water to restore underground water tables, which have been dwindling for years. Meteorologists, some of whom have referred to this year's El Nino as Godzilla, caution that the rains may not materialize.
For each of the past 2 years, Lummi Nation tribal members have carved and transported totem poles thousands of miles to raise public awareness and strengthen opposition to the export of fossil fuels from the west coast of the United States and Canada. Starting this Friday, the Lummi House of Tears Carvers, led by Master Carver Jewel James, will embark on their third journey with a new totem pole, which will be a gift to the Northern Cheyenne of Montana. Working in close association with other tribal governments, environmental organizations, and the faith-based community, these efforts have helped shape the public debate and understanding of what is at risk with the proposed fossil fuel export facilities and their transport by rail, ship, and pipeline. Starting off in Vancouver, British Columbia on Friday and Saturday, the pole's journey will take it to Longview, Washington on Sunday for an event and ceremony at St. Stephen's Episcopal Church at 6 p.m. It will arrive in Portland on Monday for a blessing ceremony at 5:30 p.m. at St. Philip Neri Catholic Church at 2408 Southeast 16th Avenue. The caravan will then stop in Hood River on Tuesday, August 25th, at the Riverside Community Church from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30. KBOO's Paul Rowland spoke earlier today with Lummi Master Carver Jewel James.
I understand you've got a new totem pole carved and ready to go on your third totem pole journey to visit sites that are impacted by coal and oil trains. So tell us about this new totem pole.
Well, this totem pole we carved specifically for the Northern Cheyenne community, but it's also in follow-up in our two prior totem pole journeys. The first totem pole journey was dealing with the Tsleil-Waututh Nation that was battling to protect the Fraser River and the Salish Sea. The second year, we became fully aware of the proposed or the damages being done by the tar sands mines to the Beaver Lake Cree people in northern Alberta. And we also became aware of the Keystone Pipeline that's going right through the heart of the Sioux Nations and their Aboriginal territory. So we carved a second totem pole and brought it from Sioux Nations up to the Pacific Northwest and on up into northern Alberta and gave it to the Beaver Lake Cree Nation in appreciation of their defense of the earth. During that time, we began to talk with the representative from the Northern Cheyenne. He's a veteran by the name of Otto Braidedhare. And it was agreed that we should deliver a third totem pole, one that's going to go to the Northern Cheyenne in appreciation of their work to defend Otter Creek from becoming the biggest open-pit coal mine in the United States. It's a 22-foot totem pole, and the designs that are on it were at the recommendation of our Cheyenne relatives.
So in these totem pole journeys, you travel through many different native and non-native communities as a way to, I assume, to bring them together in awareness of all these various threats to the waters and to the land. Is that right?
Yes. The big problem is that it's really difficult for the average citizen to hold their government accountable. A lot of times the administrative processing of licenses and permits are set up in order to assure that the company can go forward with their industrialization, irregardless of the major impact they have upon the air, the water, the land. And we have a lot of citizens and individuals that are concerned about how to protect the earth. This involves not only citizens' organizations, but environmental organizations. And a lot of the interfaith community has stepped forward and has been trying to defend the earth as a gift from God. And so all these people are doing their own projects, trying to stand up and demand that the earth be protected. And so we saw this as an opportunity for us to try to pull together the tribes, the citizens, the environmental groups, and the interfaith community so that we have a united front and we support each other for the efforts to get the message out to the general community and the people around us that these projects are major threats to the health of their families and their children.
So talk about some of the choices of the communities that you're going through. Specifically, I know you're planning to stop in Hood River and Longview and in Portland. Talk a little bit about those communities and why you're choosing to stop there.
Well, first of all, we represent the Lummi Indian Nation in our official capacity as the managers of the Lummi Sovereignty and Treaty Protection Office. Our mission is to protect the traditional territories of the Lummi Nation, and especially the fishing grounds and territories of the Lummi Treaty fishermen. And well, we've been having problems with the Army Corps of Engineers not standing up as a and defending our treaty rights. We have a treaty relationship with the United States, and once it was ratified by the Senate, it became supreme law of the land, and it's been upheld by the Supreme Court time and again. But yet we have an administrative process that's belittling or pretty much ignoring the concerns of the Lummi Nation in regards to protecting the marine waters, their usual and custom fishing grounds. Now, Cherry Point is a historic village, so it has a lot of cultural value to the Lummi people. In addition, the state of Washington's Historic Preservation Office recognizes it as probably one of the largest ancestral burial grounds in the state. With that, we've been trying our best to defend Cherry Point and to stop this, because not only will the coal cause a mercury and arsenic poisoning of the air and the waters, but it's going to destroy our burial grounds. In addition, it's going to be drawing water out of the Nooksack River. Yeah, right now we're all suffering in droughts, and they want to keep use 1.5 billion gallons a year to keep the coal wet. Now, the other site is Longview, and the third site is Port of Morrill. Between the three sites, about 153 million tons of coal is going to be proposed for export. If all three opened, that would be 38 train loads a day coming to the Northwest. Each train is overloaded with coal, and about one ton of coal falls off the train en route. So 38 trains times one ton is 38 tons of coal being sprinkled throughout the Pacific Northwest. This will impact every stream, every river, every waterway that the train route is following. So we have impacts north of us through the proposed pipeline for tar sands oil, which is extremely toxic and heavy and will sink down to the bottom of the ocean. We have another shipwreck, and then we have the oil trains falling over and crashing and causing deaths in various cities, and then we got these coal trains. And so we know that all the Salish tribes have come together and the Columbia River tribes to try to defend the quality of the environment.
So again, there's three opportunities for people in the KBOO listening area, or four actually, possibly. Sunday, as you said, at Longview, and Monday at St. Philip Neri Church here in Portland.
Yes, on Longview, we're going to be at St. Stephen's Episcopal Church on August 23rd.
At what time?
At 6 to 7:30 p.m.
Okay.
Then in Portland, we're going to be at St. Philip Neri Catholic Church, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. on August 24th.
Okay.
On August 25th, we're going to be at Hood River from 11 o'clock to 2 o'clock.
And so any other words for our listeners about what the importance?
Well, we're all experiencing the impacts of global warming. The Pacific Northwest from California, Oregon, and Washington, Idaho, and Montana are suffering severe fire damages. And with the rivers getting shallow, we all know that the salmon returning to Columbia River are dying en masse. And it's time for all citizens, all environmental groups, and all churches to stand up together. We all mutually have a duty to protect the earth for our children.
And of course, the indigenous people, I really admire you for, you know, taking the lead on this, and obviously, as you say, everybody else really needs to join in and follow your lead.
Well, you know, back in 1987, 10 bishops from 9 different denominations issued an original apology to the Northwest tribes for having helped destroy our spiritual belief and practices, and committed to working with us. They recommitted to that very statement in 1997 and 2007. I know in 2007 the Catholic Church did not sign off on the new version of that declaration, but with the Pope Francis releasing his encyclical letter in May of this year, the Catholic Church has committed to helping activate their community to help save the earth. And so we need to have the interfaith community to co-coordinate and develop a plan as to how all of them are going to work together to try to convince their members of their parishes, of the interfaith community, to step forward and take action.
Okay, well, thank you. Jewel James, Master Carver and Treaty Rights Protector from the Lummi Indian Nation, we thank you so much, and good luck with your journey.
Thank you.
That was KBOO's Paul Rowland reporting.
When the Moreland Farmers Pantry was set to open, Selwood residents looked forward to a high-end grocery store in their rapidly gentrifying neighborhood. But when the owner's political beliefs were made public, controversy swirled. Owner Chauncey Childs has posted to Facebook about gay marriage, saying that it would pave the way for bigamy and pedophilia. A local blogger exposed the post in 2014 before the store ever opened. The store was subject to boycotts and taunts thereafter. Now, after less than a year in business, the store is closing down, according to its social media pages. No reason for the closure was given. The controversy roped in other local personalities as restaurateur and food blogger Nick Zukin defended the store and received criticism himself.
The U.S. Department of Energy says prices for wind power are at an all-time low and turbine installation prices have fallen significantly in its new report on the wind market. Oregon is one of only 15 states where wind energy makes up more than 12% of the power generated in state. Will lower prices change that picture? Comments from Cliff Gilmore, Communications Director at Renewable Northwest.
Wind energy prices have hit an all-time low, and the cost of installing turbines has fallen 20 to 40% in the last 5 years, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Its new report says last year's wind power price contracts with utilities averaged under 2.5 cents per kilowatt hour, down from 7 cents in 2009. In the Northwest, that could mean a resurgence of interest and investment in wind farms. Cliff Gilmore with Renewable Northwest says wind has a special advantage over power generation from fossil fuels.
When you're talking about wind, you don't need to worry about that fuel cost. The fuel is the wind. So the advantage, if you have a renewable resource, whether it's wind or solar or whatever, if the price of putting that in goes down, then that means the price of that energy goes down.
The report also says wind turbine sizes are changing, allowing them to produce more power at lower wind speeds. The American Wind Energy Association says Oregon has more than 1,800 turbines and 10 manufacturing facilities for wind equipment and supplies. Oregon ranks sixth among states for its installed wind capacity, but much of the power isn't used here. Gilmore says it's important to think of clean power generation as regional, which means for investors, the market isn't limited.
About 50% of the wind generated in the Northwest here is sold down into California. Quite a bit of the solar then generated in California is sold up here. And the idea there is that it's sold when needed.
The Energy Department says one-third of the new generating capacity added in the U.S. since 2007 has been wind power, but in total it meets just under 5% of the nation's electricity demand. I'm Chris Thomas, Oregon News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview that will be of great interest. That'll be followed by Occupy Portland Radio at 6 o'clock. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 79, moving to clear and in the high 50s at night. Today in history, in 1989, Hungary opened its border with Austria as part of the Pan-European Picnic, allowing several hundred East Germans to defect to the West. Our quote of the day is from Terry Pratchett, who said, "They say a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, but it's not one half so bad as a lot of ignorance."
It is 5:27. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Great news! Walmart is investing in American jobs. It says so right here in a colorful, full-page ad showing a very happy Walmart worker displaying more than a dozen brand-name products made in the good old USA. The ad even gives a website, madewithamericanjobs.com, and says we can learn more by checking it out. So, I did. Yikes! The website is filled with stuff not made in America. In the special tips and ideas section touting gifts for Father's Day, Walmart promotes smartphones, none made in the U.S., flat-screen TVs, made in Korea, Japan, China, etc., and other foreign-made electronic gadgets that, quote, will leave Dad happy. Other sections of the web store offer a Taiwan computer, T-shirts from Fruit of the Loom, which closed its last U.S. plant in 2014, and an imported tent bearing Walmart's own house brand. In fact, out of some 5 million products available for online purchase from Walmart, less than 5,000, one-half of 1%, are U.S. made. 2 years ago, when Walmart CEO announced the dazzling Made with American Jobs campaign, he pledged to create 1 million new jobs for American workers. Apparently, most of those are to be in advertising firms and PR agencies hired to hype the corporation's attempt to bamboozle us into thinking there's some substance to the promise to invest in America. For example, one PR promotion touted a towel maker in Georgia as a beneficiary of the retailer's new initiative. But the company actually added a mere 35 jobs and was keeping 90% of its production overseas. This is Jim Hightower saying, so far, Walmart's highly ballyhooed USA campaign has produced only about 2,000 of the 1 million jobs promised. The ad campaign expresses a nice sentiment, but where's the commitment?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The White House hired its first openly transgender staffer this week. That staffer is trans woman named Rafi Friedman-Gurspan, who was hired as an outreach and recruitment director. Friedman-Gurspan, who is 28, previously worked for the National Center for Transgender Equality and in the office of Representative Carl Sciortino, a Democrat from Massachusetts. She was born in Honduras and adopted into a family in suburban Brookline, Massachusetts. A book written by Rafi's mother, Marion, describes the younger woman's transition as a college student in Minnesota. Marion Friedman-Gurspan said that Rafi began fighting for trans rights then as she battled to get the housing she needed from St. Olaf College. Congressman Sciortino applauded the hiring, saying, quote, "Rafi is a role model. I am proud to see her continuing to lead by example as she takes her voice and her passion to the White House."
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
Taking people's power away!
Thousands of protesters have poured into the streets across New Zealand, calling on their country to walk away from negotiations of the TPP. More than 2,000 people recently marched in the small New Zealand city of Dunedin, where activist Rob Stewart addressed the crowd.
"We don't want this thing to go through. We're here as leaders of our community telling them, no way. Who's with me?"
The TPP is highly controversial, not only because of the secrecy that surrounds it, but also because of leaked portions of the agreement that trade experts say could have serious negative implications for citizens of the signing countries. They've warned the TPP could affect everything from the price of medicine to copyright laws to state-owned enterprises like CBC or Radio New Zealand. Activist and social worker Jen Olson organized the recent anti-TPP protest in Dunedin. She thinks New Zealanders are upset about the TPP for a lot of the same reasons people in other countries are, including its confidentiality.
A big one is, of course, the secrecy itself and the fact that once people find out that something as wide-ranging and important as the TPP is happening kind of under their noses but being hidden, that is something that concerns a lot of people, and they want to find out more.
That very secrecy is at the core of a joint court case pending against the New Zealand government. Legal scholar Jane Kelsey is leading the legal action on behalf of 7 organizations, including Consumer New Zealand, Oxfam, and Greenpeace. Back in January, she filed an official information request for a number of TPP-related documents, including the draft text itself. When Kelsey requested the documents, Trade Minister Tim Grosser refused to hand them over. So now the group is taking him to court. They filed the court papers on August 5th. Kelsey can't talk about the details of the legal case before it's heard by New Zealand's High Court, but she can say it's challenging the right of the New Zealand government to keep the TPP a secret.
"We are questioning the interpretation that the minister has made of the powers to withhold documents under New Zealand's domestic legislation, irrespective of whatever they may have agreed to externally."
If the petitioners prevail and the TPP draft texts are released, it would be the ultimate victory in a years-long public education campaign about the trade agreement.
"Once people understand what the issues are and how it affects them, then they have become vocal. And we've seen politicians also, including now the Labor Party, expressing their own concern. And so I think it's simply been a matter of education, around something that is very obtuse.
Japanese opponents to the TPP have also launched their own constitutional challenge to the secrecy of the agreement. That legal action mirrors a spirited public engagement about the TPP that the Japanese and New Zealand public share.
My experience is that, in fact, the debates in New Zealand have been amongst the most vibrant, perhaps from Japan.
Kelsey thinks that vibrancy could, in large part, be explained simply.
New Zealand does not have a free trade agreement with the US, and nor does Japan. A number of the other countries, if you look at Chile or Peru, they already have FTAs with the US. So many of the more extreme demands that the US is making in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, especially in the non-trade areas such as intellectual property or investment, other countries have already made.
Olson has also noticed the interest that the TPP has piqued in New Zealand, as evidenced by the recent week of widespread public actions and rallies. She attributes it, at least in part, to a deep and enduring skepticism of the national government.
I think that in New Zealand, if people get the idea that someone's trying to pull the wool over their eyes, they don't like it. And they're more and more likely to say, no, I want to know about that. I'm not going to let that go. They don't accept it. There's not so much conformity, perhaps. And I certainly think in the United States that there's a higher level of political conformity and a less of political discussion and information and understanding in the general community than there is here.
So be happy as you slave away, locked into your lowly wage, cause the TPP is good for...
When talks in Maui last month failed to reach a conclusion, New Zealand activists and even some industry opponents rejoiced. It bought them more time to convince the public of the ills of the TPP, Olson says. And time is ticking. Canada has elections coming up in October, and the United States has its own roadshow of an election cycle rapidly approaching. Global trade analysts speculate that if Canada and the U.S. don't sign the TPP before their respective political changeovers, they never will. But New Zealand Prime Minister John Key insists New Zealand will be able to close the deal and said negotiators were getting, quote, close to the final bits of the issues at hand. Further TPP negotiations are tentatively planned for later this month. Carla Green, FSRN, New Zealand.
John Key, champion of democracy. John Key, John Key.
A sociologist and expert in immigration policy took to the pages of Foreign Policy magazine yesterday to denounce Donald Trump's immigration plan, calling it moronic. Douglas Massey, a Princeton sociology professor and author of several books on the subject, asserted that Trump's plan is not only costly but counterproductive. Reforms passed during the Reagan and Clinton administrations led to a militarized border. Intended to discourage illegal immigration, they instead made it harder for migrant workers to go home and see their families. Increasingly, undocumented workers have elected to stay in the United States and raise families here rather than risk further border crossings. Among other things, Trump proposes to build a wall along the length of the U.S.-Mexico border, making undocumented border crossings effectively impossible.
And now we bring you a bit of labor history.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises.
For Workers Independent News, I'm Joanne Powers.
Temporary workers are being put into jobs that are extremely dangerous to begin with. They're not provided adequate protections. This results in very high rates of workplace fatalities as well as serious injuries.
That's Peter Dooley, a workplace health and safety specialist with the National Council on Occupational Safety and Health. The council is calling for action to protect the millions of temp workers across the U.S. who are sent into potentially hazardous situations with little or no training. Studies show temp workers are far more likely to be injured on the job than regular workers, with over 700 fatalities in 2013. The campaign marks the third anniversary of the death of temporary worker Day Davis.
He was a 23-year-old worker. First day on the job, getting employed by a staffing agency who was then hired out to Bacardi Rum, and he gets sent into a job which we know in the safety industry is a disaster waiting to happen. He's in an area underneath a crusher machine kind of thing, and he's crushed by the machine. Just a horrible, horrible story that puts a face on the 2+ temp workers who are killed every single day of the year. And this just has to stop.
At the end of July, Ahold USA became the 14th corporation and the first major grocery store to sign on to the Fair Food Program, a groundbreaking program pioneered by the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida to improve the lives of farm workers. Rabbi Raquel Kahn-Troster is director of programs at TRUA, the Rabbinical Call for Human Rights, the major Jewish ally organization of the CIW. She noted that the Fair Food Agreement requires the company to pay a 1 cent per pound premium for tomatoes that goes directly to the workers, and to only purchase tomatoes from Florida growers who have implemented a human rights code of conduct designed by the workers themselves.
At zero tolerance for things like forced labor, wage theft, violence in the field, sexual harassment. 15% of farm workers are women, and they face sexual harassment and sexual assault every day, and that's ended on farms that are part of the Fair Food Program, so that women farm workers don't have to make a choice between earning a fair wage and feeding their families or holding on to their dignity and respect.
Kahn-Troster hopes Ahold bringing Fair Food tomatoes to 50 million new customers will put pressure on other grocery chains to follow suit.
When you have an option to support the human rights of the workers in your supply chain, that should be a given. They really have a moral obligation to their workers to become part of the Fair Food Program. To be able to see the Fair Food Program coming into America's neighborhood grocery stores, supporting a worker-driven model of human rights and social responsibility is really important.
WIN is made possible in part through underwriting support from the International Association of Machinists and from the United Auto Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Protesters against the planned Trans-Pacific Partnership gathered in New Zealand recently in a large display of resistance to these secret negotiations. While foreigners were warned against attending the protest for fear of violence breaking out, the protest remained peaceful and many non-Kiwis came out. This report is from Carla Beach Radio Network.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1909. That was the day that a committee of the Industrial Workers of the World in Spokane, Washington, published the first edition of the Little Red Songbook. The collection were songs to fan the flames of discontent. Perhaps more than any other labor organization in the United States, members of the IWW understood the power of art to tell the workers' stories. IWW members created music, visual art, and writing to draw people to the cause of labor and to build solidarity among workers. Richard Brazier was an IWW musician who served on the Spokane committee that compiled the collection. He explained, "What first attracted me to the IWW was its songs and the gusto with which its members sang them. Such singing, I thought, was good propaganda, since it had originally attracted me, and many others as well, and also useful, since it held the crowd for wobbly speakers who followed." The original Little Red Songbook included songs such as Solidarity Forever and the French song The Internationale. 30 editions of the pocket-sized book were published between 1909 and 1995. They have included labor songs from musicians such as Joe Hill, Ralph Chaplin, and T-Bone Slim. John Reed, a former IWW journalist, reflected on the organization's powerful connection to music. He wrote, "Remember, this is the only American working class movement which sang. Tremble then at the IWW, for a singing movement is not to be beaten. Do you have a favorite labor song?"
Solidarity forever.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Solidarity forever, for the union makes us strong.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joseph Jordan and Jimmy Tardy. The producer is Galen Sanford. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg.
A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here come the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. Local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett.
Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock is Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 o'clock, it's Voices from the Edge with Joanne Hardesty. At 9 o'clock, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, host Per Fogering speaks with Michael T. Klar about his article, Big Oil in Retreat, which argues that the dynamics of the energy industry may be changing in a way that could sink Canada's vast tar sands enterprise in a sea of red ink. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with guest host Kevin Pina. And at 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, David Nyman speaks with local poet and critic David Beispiel about his collection of essays called A Long High Whistle. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Have a great evening.
It's time for KBOO News from the Boo with
Mike
and
Monica Beamer.